Let's turn to Obadiah. I'd like to read the first 11 verses. The vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. Thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, Who shall bring me down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. If thieves came to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes? How are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread hath laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom, and understanding out of the mount of Esau? And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. In the day that thou stoodst on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. Now, I touched on the story just a few minutes ago. They were twins, but they could not have been more different. The older was a man's man, the favorite of his father. The younger was a mama's boy. The older was sacrilegious. The younger was a shyster. And at the time they parted, the younger had taken advantage of the older and gotten his birthright. And when the older realized what had happened, that he couldn't get it back, he told the younger he was going to kill him. And of course, we're talking about Jacob and Esau. And if you don't think that family trouble can last a long time, you don't know the story of Jacob and Esau. Of all human conflicts, the absolute worst are civil wars, in which brother is set against brother, in which brother kills brother. The bitterness is greater, the hatred is deeper than when families have a falling out. And what started as a falling out between two brothers had national implications. In Deuteronomy 23, Moses had told Israel, Thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother. But in Ezekiel 35, verse 5, Edom didn't see things that way. Ezekiel tells us that they had a perpetual hatred against Israel. And although Obadiah is not written to Israel, it is written to Israel. And Obadiah is going to tell us something about what's involved in brotherly love. Now, one thing about the prophets is that they were courageous men. I love to read the stories that come to us from the prophets. A good example would be in 1 Kings 22, when Jehoshaphat goes up to Samaria to visit his in-law Ahab. And Ahab is wanting to recover a city, Ramoth Gilead, that the Syrians had taken from Israel and had refused to turn back over. And he wants Jehoshaphat to go up with him. And Jehoshaphat says, what does God say? And Ahab says, well, my prophets tell me that if we go up, we'll prosper. And Jehoshaphat says, no, I don't mean what does Baal say. All of your prophets are Baal prophets, Ahab. Is there not here a prophet of Jehovah of whom we might inquire? And Ahab says, there is one man, Micaiah, son of Imlah, but I hate him. Listen, I'll hire Micaiah to preach for me on that recommendation alone. The preacher I want is the preacher that Ahab hates. I hate him because he always prophesies bad about me, never anything good. And Jehoshaphat says, "Now don't talk that way. Let's see what Micaiah has to say." And so they fetch Micaiah, and the text, I think, implies that he's already locked up, maybe. I mean, they knew right where to get him. And the guard that goes to get him gives him some advice. He says, "Now listen, you want to get out of here? You tell Ahab what he needs to hear." And Micaiah says, "No, I'll tell him what God tells me to say." And so they bring Micaiah in, and they put the question to him, "What's going to happen if we go up to Ramoth-Gilead?" And Micaiah says, "You'll win. Go up and prosper." And immediately, you know, you're thinking, now has Micaiah sold out? Has he gone over to the other side? Is he like our American politicians who get elected on one platform and then vote with the other side? Well, apparently there was something in his tone or maybe in his appearance when he said, "Go up and prosper," because as soon as he says it, Ahab says, "See, Jehoshaphat, I told you, he never has anything good to say about me." And so Ahab said, "Now you come clean, Micaiah. You tell us the truth." Micaiah said, "Okay, I'll tell you the truth. You go up to Ramoth-Gilead, you're going to die." And Ahab got so upset about that, he sent Micaiah back to jail, or he put him in jail if he had not been in jail, on a diet of bread and water. He went up to Ramoth-Gilead and he died of his wounds up there. And so far as I know, Micaiah died in prison, eating bread, drinking water. But that story of courage may have so impressed some parents down the road that they named a son after him. We know him as the prophet Micah. And the reason I say that is because Micah begins his prophecy to Judah the same way Micaiah began his speech to Ahab. And so these were courageous men. They did not speak in abstractions. They didn't beat around the bush. They got right to the point. And that's what Obadiah is going to do in this book. He's not going to pull any punches in what he says to Edom. And from this, let's try to understand something about what is involved in brotherly love. Now, if we're going to date this prophecy, there's a good chance Obadiah was the first of the writing prophets. And the reason I say that is because the conditions he describes in this book regarding Edom only fit two periods of time, either about the year 845 B.C. or the year 586 B.C. And here are the five conditions. He's discussing a time when Jerusalem is being judged and Edom is out from under the hand of Israelite domination. And in this book, Edom is independent. Jerusalem has been invaded. In fact, it's been sacked. Thirdly, Jerusalem has been invaded by strangers, by Gentiles, not by Israel coming down from the north. Fourthly, captives, Jewish captives have been taken. And fifthly, there would come a time when Judah would again subjugate Edom. Now, four of those five apply to 586, but all five of them only apply to about the year 845. So I tend to think that Obadiah is one of the earliest of the prophets. And he has a lot to say about brotherly love and brotherly hatred. Now I want to divide the paragraph, the passage I just read, into two sections. In the first nine verses, we'll talk about the root of hatred. And in verses 10 and 11, we'll talk about the reaction of hatred. Now let's go back through this text and look at the story. In verse 1, a diplomatic mission is described. Some diplomats, ambassadors, have been going around the region like a secretary of state hopping from one capital to the next, inciting Edom's neighbors against her, encouraging Edom's neighbors to go to war, creating an alliance, a league of nations that's going to go against Edom. Now, God is the one behind that diplomatic mission. God is the one behind stirring up the nations because He wants Edom brought down. And in verses 2 through 9, He tells us what the root of Edom's problem is. Verse 2, it's pride. I've made you small among the nations, verse 3, because the pride of your heart has deceived you. C.S. Lewis called pride the chief sin. G.K. Chesterton called it the chief anti-God attitude. You know, we're told in the Psalms that when a man wanted to make a god, he always made a god that let him do what he wants to do. Psalm 115. And the Jews were no different than the Gentiles. You know, your God is whatever is most important to you. Whatever that is, that's your God. If drinking, carousing, if that's the most important thing to you, you made a God and you called Him Bacchus. If beauty, if style over substance was more important, you worshipped a goddess called Venus. If you were into sex, why, Aphrodite was the goddess for you. Or if you were into force and power and might makes right, if you were a terrorist, you worshipped Mars. Or suppose you thought science and technology was where it was at, that knowledge and education was the way to go. If that's what was most important to you, you worshipped the muses and you went to church at a place called a museum. But whenever you set out to make yourself a god, you always made a god that let you do what you wanted to do. And the biggest god I have a problem with is named Kenny Chumley. And that's the god that is most in view in the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." I put myself ahead of God more than I put anything else ahead of God, and that's pride. That's what pride is, putting yourself ahead of God. And when you put yourself first, not only are you going to have problems with God, you're going to have problems with the people who live under the same roof as you. When you put yourself first, you're not going to get along with the person across the street or next door. There'll be trouble when the family gets together. When you go into work, you put yourself first. And there's going to be problems. And that's what Edom was doing. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. And in verses 3 and 4, God accurately describes the topography of Edom. Some of you have been there. I was talking with Mo. He's been to Petra. The word Petra means rock. Upon this rock I will build my church. Edom said, no, in these rocks we put our trust. You know, there are canyons in that part of the world with narrow passageways where they could hold the pass. And if they didn't hold the pass, they would climb up their ropes and up their ladders to get into their caves that they had dug out and enlarged, and they'd pull the ropes up there, and like the Jews at Masada, they had plenty of provisions and they could outlast the enemy. They were just like eagles there in verse 4. Out of reach. Thinking nobody can get to us. But in verse 4, God says, it doesn't matter that you put your nest up in the stars. I'm going to bring you down. Listen, when God gets a nation in His crosshairs, it doesn't matter how many atomic bombs they've got. It doesn't matter how many planes and tanks they've got. God is going to bring them down. And Edom's rocks, her impregnable Eri, was not going to save them. I mean, verse 4 is worth memorizing in regard to all of the national turmoil that exists in this world today. Pride was the root of Edom's sin. And God's judgment against Edom is fierce, starting in verse 5. God says your wealth is going to be plundered. A few years ago, I came home from work one day to find that my house had been broken into. Now, here's what I found curious. They took the money they could find. They didn't take the trash. The there were a lot of things they just left behind. Didn't interest them at all. But in verse 5 and 6, God says, those who come into Edom are not going to leave anything behind. Now, the harvest is going on in central Illinois right now. And I was raised on the farm. My mom still lives on the farm. Reggie Peters, a kid I grew up with, farms the farm. And they pull in with those combines and those big corn pickers. They never take every kernel of corn out of the field. They never take every bean out of a soybean field. There's corn and beans left everywhere. But God says, verse 5 and 6, when the ones I send in come in, they're not going to leave even a single grape. They're going to pluck you clean. And in verse 7, the alliances you'd form with other nations, thinking that if you had a NATO going on here, that would protect you against stronger enemies, those alliances are going to be broken. I have no doubt whatsoever that whenever America gets weak enough, some of our most trusted allies will turn against us. And they'll be at the head of the line, waiting to pick up the spoils in this country. In verse 8, Edom's wisdom is going to be destroyed. You know, Eliphaz, Job's friend, was from Teman, which is mentioned here. He was an Edomite. Edom's joint chiefs of staff were not going to be able to make good decisions when the invasion started, when the fight came. And when the people at the top don't know whether to charge or retreat, you know, that army's doomed for trouble. And in verse 9, the fact of the matter is, Edom's army was going to be destroyed. It was going to be slaughtered. All of this because of pride. Because of thinking they were untouchable. Because of thinking, take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. You know, we are set for a long time. But in particular, in this book, Edom's pride manifested itself in its attitude toward Israel, toward Jacob. And verses 10 and 11 is where I want us to look now. Because here's the reaction of hatred. If the root of hatred is pride, putting ourselves first, how does hatred often express itself? Let's read verse 10 and 11 again. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, for thy violence, underline that, for thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. Okay, I understand that. But what constituted their violence? Verse 11. In the day that thou stoodst on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. In the day you stood on the other side and did nothing. Now, actually, they did do something. They did do some piling on. They did do some kicking after Judah was already down. But the first definition of their violence is that they stood on the other side. They were a spiritual Switzerland, not getting involved. Have you ever heard a good brother maligned in your presence, slandered by someone, and you said nothing in his defense? Have you ever seen a hurting person in a ditch and passed by on the other side? Maybe you were late for an appointment. Maybe you just didn't want to get involved. My mother told me, don't pick up hitchhikers. You know, maybe it was a trap, an ambush. Have you ever seen another headed for disaster because of the choices they are making in their life? And you gave no warning. You stood on the other side, arms folded. I've done that. Can I tell you that? I'm ashamed of it. There were times I was silent when I should have spoke. Sometimes silence isn't golden. Sometimes it's yellow. And God says, that is violence. Listen, I've had people lie about me, and I found out that people I thought who were my friends did not stick up for me. They knew better. They knew it wasn't true. But it's just easier for them not to get involved. That's like getting punched in the gut when you hear something like that. And God says, Edom, that is violence. We've all seen pictures of rioters when a riot breaks out, smashing the store windows, people going in, carrying out TVs and merchandise, and then there's a group on the other side just kind of standing back watching it, not lifting a finger to stop it. I want to tell you something. Love is not neutral. The golden rule, which is but a definition of love, but an expression, a statement of love, is a rule that calls for action. Do unto others. And to stand back when someone needs to be defended. To stand back when someone's hurting. And to do nothing is an act of violence. Someone says, well, yeah, but Judah deserved it. God was punishing Judah. Now, here's an important distinction. I can cite numerous examples from Scripture where somebody was getting what they deserved. God was behind it. But God expected that person's fellows to show love and mercy regardless. Remember David after Saul's death? Here's a man who's been on the run from an evil psychotic, has narrowly escaped death at this man's hands on numerous occasions, has been in such despair. I'm talking about David now. He's been in such despair because of Saul's behavior that twice, not once but twice, he went over to the enemy. Went down to the Philistines, seeking political asylum. And news comes that Saul has fallen. You think David would be dancing on his grave? You read the eulogy that David paid to Saul. He said, the beauty of Israel is fallen. Oh, how the mighty are fallen. That's what God expects of us. That kind of an attitude. It's God's prerogative to judge. There's one judge. We're not He. And God expects us to show love even to those who've not been loving toward us. Now, turn to 1 John. I said something last night about the three tests of life that we have in 1 John. And John cycles through these three tests several times. And the tests are the test of belief. A person who says that Jesus is not the Christ, or that Christ did not come in the flesh, a person who attacks the incarnation is an antichrist. You can't believe that Jesus is not the Christ and go to heaven. You can't believe that God did not become flesh and go to heaven. So the belief test, the obedience test. A man says, I know Him, he ought to walk like Jesus walked. And then preeminently the love test. Now I want you to look at three passages. The first is chapter 2, verses 7 through 11. The second is chapter 3, 16 to 18. The third is chapter 4, verse 10. But in chapter 2, John tells us what love avoids, and what it avoids is scandal. Look at verse 7. Brethren, I write no new commandment unto you, but an old commandment which ye had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word which ye have heard from the beginning. Again, a new commandment I write unto you, which thing is true in him and in you, because the darkness is past and the true light now shineth. He that saith he is in the light and hateth his brother is in darkness even until now. He that loveth his brother abides in the light, and there is no occasion of stumbling. There's no scandal in him. Now, Christ told his disciples that if you cause a little one to stumble, you ought to be fitted for a concrete coat and dumped in the ocean. That's how bad it is to rob another of their faith. And that's what it means to offend someone, to cause them to stumble. That doesn't mean you wear a tie they don't like. It's to rob them of their faith, to do something that turns them against the Lord. And hatred does that. Acting hatefully, acting like Edom acted, refusing to come to another's aid, or actively promoting hatred will cause another to stumble. I'll tell you this to illustrate this. The congregation where I preach now, small country congregation, I've known those people all my life. 50 years ago, had a nest of child molesters in it. They're all dead now. But what they did 50 years ago has fallout that has continued to this day. Some of those molested were relatives of mine. I've got one cousin who would no more set foot in a Church of Christ than she would stick her head in a hot oven. What was done to her by the preacher, what was done to her by her father, who was a deacon, and maybe some others, has robbed her. Now, she's not guiltless. She's responsible for her decisions. I don't mean to imply that. But the hatred shown her has made her almost impossible to reach with the gospel message. Love avoids that kind of scandal. Look at chapter 3, verse 16 through 18. Everybody has heard of the golden text of the Bible, John 3:16. For God so loved the world. Well, in 1 John 3:16, hereby perceive we the love of God, because He laid down His life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. When I first began preaching full-time to the Oak Grove congregation south of Louisville, Kentucky in 1974, I didn't know anything about anything. And I get down there and they're studying 1 John, so I've got to teach 1 John. So I'm trying to figure out what 1 John is all about. I'll never forget us reading verse 16 and a brother looking at that. Hereby perceive we the love of God, because He laid down His life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. I remember him saying, I just don't think I can do that. He's being honest. The fact of the matter is, if John is only saying that the way we show our love for another is by taking the bullet for them, by dying in their place, none of us yet have obviously shown any love for another, because we're all still here. I wrote an article a few days ago about Alexander Russell, who was a young officer on the HMS Birkenhead, headed for South Africa, transporting his company, the Highland Light Infantry. And the ship hit an uncharted rock and began going down. And it was from that tragedy, I think, which occurred about 1850, that the protocol Women and Children First came into being. As the ship was going down and women and children being put in the lifeboats, of which there were not enough, The Highland Light Infantry stood at attention on the deck. And Kipling immortalized that action in his poem about the soldiers and sailors. But to stand and be still to the Birkenhead drill is a difficult thing to do. And because Russell was young and an officer, he was put in one of the lifeboats to be in charge. And so the lifeboat is pulling away from the Birkenhead, and suddenly a woman in the boat screams and she says, "There's my husband in the water." And without a moment's hesitation, Russell dives into the water, helps her husband up into the boat, and before he can get back in the boat, is attacked by sharks and killed. And we honor people like that. But I've never been in that situation. But I'll tell you a situation I've been in. Look at verse 17. "But whoso hath this world's good, and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him?" It's an argument from the greater to the lesser. Verse 16, if we ought to be willing to sacrifice for our brother. Verse 17, how much more ought we be willing to serve our brother? John says, if you've got something that your brother needs and you see, doesn't say you hear. You know, we tell people, if I can be of help, give me a call. John says, when you see a brother has need, you serve him. Love avoids scandal. But what does love do? It serves. Verse 18, "Let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth." And then look at chapter 4, verse 10. What does love avoid? It avoids scandal. What does love do? It serves. But in verse 10, what love is? It's a solution. Verse 10, "Herein is love." This is not a description. This is the essence. "Herein is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins." Two things, according to John, are found at the core of love. The first is that love takes the first step. Love doesn't sit back thinking, you know, they're the problem. They caused this. They need to come to me. They know what they've done. I shouldn't have to go and tell them. That's not the way God dealt with us. Verse 19, chapter 4, "We love Him because He first loved us." Love takes the first step. And then secondly, love at its core, and here's the hard part, takes the blame. You see that word propitiation? Last night we were talking from 1 Corinthians 13, how love bears all things, and I ask, will love bear the blame, the guilt, when it's innocent? A month ago, I was in London. I did something I'd never done. I went to see a stage play that was not a musical. I've seen lots of Broadway musicals, but this is the first time I went and saw a play that was a play, and the play was Henrik Ibsen's A Doll's House. When it appeared in the late 19th century, it caused a scandal. Ibsen was the prophet of individualism. In this play, a mother and a wife walks out on her husband and children at the end of the play. And in the late 19th century, mothers and wives just didn't do that. No matter how bad things were at home, they didn't do things like that. But there's something genius about this play. I had read the play before I went and saw it, and then I saw there's something genius because Ibsen understood something about love and he understood something about hatred. And here's what happens in the play. Nora, the protagonist, the heroine, her husband, Thorvald, had gotten sick, and she was afraid he was going to die. And so without telling him, in fact, fibbing a bit, She went to a guy and borrowed some money so that she could take her husband to a warmer climate where he could recover. She told her husband her father had given her the money. And she told the man she borrowed the money from that her father would co-sign, but she forged her father's signature. And he gave her the money. And she took her husband to a warmer climate. He got well. They moved back to wherever they lived. He was a big-time banker, ramrod straight, no monkey business about him whatsoever. And he would have little pet names for Nora, and just so lovey-dovey around her. Oh, he loved her so much, he'd do anything for her. And then the day came when he found out what she had done. That she had misled him and she had forged a signature. She thought, and it's in the play, she thought that when he found out, he would be willing to bear the blame for her. But when he found out, he explodes and said, "You hypocrite, you liar, you criminal, you have no religion, you have no morals, you've ruined me. My entire happiness is gone. Why, people might even think I was in on this with you, that I was an accomplice, that I'm the one behind it." It wasn't long after that, a letter arrives in which the husband finds out it's all been taken care of. No one's going to be exposed. Everything's okay. And on a dime, he turns and he's lovey-dovey again. Willing to do anything for her except take the blame. He was innocent after all. The word propitiation, it means to placate, it means to appease. But it also means in order to effect a reconciliation. If need be, you're willing to take the blame. That's what Jesus Christ did. 1 John 2:2 says He became a propitiation for us. My sins, my guilt were put on Him. He took the blame and bore my punishment. And because He did that, there's now a solution to the sin problem. Because atonement has been made, a sacrifice has been offered that God has accepted. And I can be one with God again. There was no way Edom was going to do that for Judah. But what about us? Turn back to Psalm 109. I want to close our study with this. Psalm 109, let's read from verse 6 to 15 and pay careful attention to this language. Psalm 109, verse 6, this is David. Verse 5, "They rewarded me evil for good and hatred for my soul, for my love. Set thou a wicked man over him. Let Satan stand at his right hand." Let there be an accuser right there. "When he shall be judged, let him be condemned. Let his prayer become sin. Let his days be few. Let another take his office. Let his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. Let his children be continually vagabonds and beg. Let them seek their bread also out of their desolate places. Let the extortioner catch all that he hath. Let the stranger spoil his labor. Let there be none to extend mercy unto him. Neither let there be any to favor his fatherless children. Let his posterity be cut off, and in the generation following, let their name be blotted out. Let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered with the Lord. Let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. Let them be before the Lord continually, that he may cut off the memory of them from the earth, because that he remembered not to show mercy, but persecuted the poor and needy man, that he might even slay the broken in heart." Folks, I wouldn't wish what I just read on my worst enemy. But that's what the person who kicks the man who is down, who is unwilling to give the fallen, whether they deserve it or not, a helping hand, that's what deserves to be done to the man who doesn't love his brother enough to show mercy. Brotherly love is tough. We often practice it the way we mail out Christmas cards. I mail Christmas cards to people who send me Christmas cards. I like those who like me. But love demands going much farther than that. And Obadiah stands as a perpetual warning to those who replace brotherly love with hatred. The last verse of Obadiah, verse 21, talks about saviors coming up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Edom's hope was going to be in a Jew who was willing to take their blame and die for their sins. And Edom could yet find redemption in the kingdom of the Son of God. And it doesn't matter whether we've been loving to this point in our life. It doesn't matter that we've shown hatred. It doesn't matter that we've stood on the other side. But what matters now is that we confess our sins and that we ask God's forgiveness. And because of what Jesus did, forgiveness will be granted full and free. No recriminations, never having to face our sins again. I'm sure glad my life story has not been made into a movie. And not just a movie that shows what everybody has seen already, but a movie that shows what was going on that I didn't think anybody was watching.